You're listening to Melissa and Lori Love Literacy. Students are really good at pointing out when the English language breaks the rules. And we teachers often say things like, English is just full of exceptions. Well, after reading the book, Uncovering the Logic of English, we realized that English actually makes a lot of sense. Today's guest is author Denise Ide, and she will share her knowledge about the English language and how knowing the logic behind our language can help you teach your students to read and spell.
Hi, teacher friends. I'm Lori.
And I'm Melissa.
We are two educators who want the best for all kids, and we know you do too.
We worked together in Baltimore when the district adopted a new literacy curriculum.
We realized there was so much more to learn about how to teach reading and writing.
Lori and I can't wait to keep learning with you today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Melissa and Lori Love Literacy. Today, we can't wait to talk with our guests because we are going to learn all about how the English language actually is very logical.
And we have a great guest for that today. We're here with Denise Ide, who is the author of Uncovering the Logic of English. For those watching the video, this is the book right here.
Ooh, mine's in the kitchen. I don't even have mine to hold up, Melissa.
And she's also the founder and CEO of Logic of English, which we'll talk all about today. So welcome, Denise.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to jump in with just, you know, Lori and I actually got to see you present last week at the Plain Talk conference. And, you know, Lori asked a question. She's like, how does someone learn so much about the English language? Like, how does she know all of this? So we wanted to ask you just to start us off with, like, how did you get to this point of learning so much and wanting to share with others about the actual English language?
Well, sure. So like so many people in the literacy space, it all began with my own children who struggled with reading. And I can read curriculum like it's a novel. So I had twin boys who were struggling with reading for several years. And I began just buying books about reading, buying curriculum, trying things with them. And I found a book in the OG kind of family of curriculum. And as I'm turning the pages, I'm like, what? C says two sounds? I didn't know that. That would have helped all my adult literacy students that I had taught in a prior career. What? G says two sounds? What? This happens before an E, I, and Y. What? There's more than these two reasons for a silent E. English words don't end in V. And right then and there, I began to make connections to my adult literacy students that I had had. And then I began to use this information to teach my sons. And it was amazing. They went from non-readers to readers in the matter of months as they learned to decode because they had strong language comprehension skills. And then I put together this presentation that I called The Logic of English because to me, it was all my favorite rules from this kind of curriculum. And fast forward, here we are today because that really caught on. That presentation resonated with people and that led to the formation of the company and all that you've seen today. So,
well, I mean, I hate to say that I'm glad that that happened because I never want children to struggle, but I am glad that it brought you to this point and that you were able to help them. And just so fascinating to hear your story. Thank you for sharing that. One thing that stood out to me is that at Plain Talk last week and in your book, Uncovering the Logic of English, like my big takeaway is all words are decodable. And I'm hoping that you can say a little bit about that, just so that we can help everyone understand our language a bit better.
Yes. So that was really the awakening maybe I had as I was reading this curriculum, was that there were a lot of concepts and rules that I didn't know. And that made English spelling for me very difficult, English decoding for my sons very difficult. And since that time, I've been able to dig into some of the other research. So in the talk you heard, I referenced that S saying z as in is often marked as an exception. So is has in the high frequency words. And it would be one thing if is and has were the only words. But really, if you look closely, it actually says z more often in the high frequency words than it says s. And even more astounding is it actually says this is over 20,000 times in this database called Finder of a number of where they're able to match the sounds to the letter sound correspondences and look that up. And so there's this misconception in our culture about what the letter sound correspondences are and what a complete set of them are. And then as kids learn to read, we're saying that's an exception, not realizing we're dismissing actually like 46% of the words with an S in it.
Which is a pretty huge percentage.
It's a pretty huge percentage. It's clearly not an exception, but it's no one's fault. I think we don't take the time to realize, wait, I was told this is an exception. Every book teaches this as a sight word. What is a sight word? instead, it's generated all of this misunderstanding about the language.
Yeah. Can we go back to something that you said? You said that it taught you something that you didn't know, like you didn't know that sound. Well, what about if you inaccurately know it or your knowledge is partial? I'm thinking about my knowledge there in certain quote rules was not whole or was inaccurate because as you pointed out at the conference for one of the rules that you taught, I only learned the first part of the rule. So I hadn't learned the complete rule. So I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that or to add to that.
Well, I think that's really where the discussion about reading is right now, everyone reads alphabet books to their kids. Everyone understands that learning the S is helpful. We just don't realize that culturally we're missing that it says the Z sound 46% of the time. And you don't know what you don't know. Instead, we just dismiss these things. I remember English words don't end in V. That was such a big eye-opener for me. Every time you hear V at the end, add an E, as in have, give, comprehensive. I just thought they were all exceptions to the vowel saying its long sound. But when we start to understand the complete picture of English, it opens up spelling, it opens up decoding. And I think something that I've been thinking a lot about is it sparks curiosity and the joy of learning in students, because then they begin to go, ooh, I see something. What is that? What's happening there? But if we just say, oh, English is crazy, it's riddled with exceptions, we can't get curious. It's just discouraging.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And I've taken some of what you taught us and already I'm using it with my 5-year-old son. So his letter from last week at preschool was C. And so, of course, they learned it was C as in cat. and I was just like, isn't it cool that it actually has two sounds? So then we like found all the circle and can't think of any off the top of my head now. City. Yeah, we found other words. I was like, isn't that cool? It has two sounds. So I'm like really trying to amp it up at home.
It's everywhere. Once you see it, it's like, oh my goodness, it's everywhere.
Yeah. And eventually we'll get to the like when it says which sound.
And with emerging readers, that's fine. Just knowing it says two sounds, I think, and I'm a big advocate of teaching these sounds right from the beginning, because like you're saying with your son, if you learn it says k isn't cat, but then you see the word city or you see the word bicycle, it doesn't make sense to go, oh, you'll learn that sound in a couple years. Really, they're encountering that sound in the books and in the texts and in the words around them. So empowering them with that information.
And I think you said something in your presentation, like some kids can kind of go with the flow and be like, oh, sure. Yeah. C has a different sound there. But for other kids, that logical, like, wait a second, you told me it was this can really throw them off.
Yeah, I've done a lot of thinking about what is it that helps some students learn it so quickly. And I think from my own observations, and I want to be very careful that these are Denise Ide observations. These aren't science of reading. They're not evidence-based. No one has put together a study. But my observations are kids need a different amount of the code. So what we'll see is we're teaching what, Laura, you described as a more complete and accurate code. Someone will have 25, 50%, and suddenly they're already reading books. Someone else needs 60, 75%, and they have enough to be able to read books. And then also, I think there's approximations that we teach. I've had this discussion. Do we really need to teach the S's and Z's, even though it's 46% of the time in the language? But what I observed is my daughter, who's very intuitive, my guess is when I said she misread it as is, and I said, no, that's is, because ns are formed in the same part of the mouth and they're a voice and unvoiced pair. My guess is she was very intuitive and is like, ah, close enough. I've got it. But my sons, they're little engineers, little science. They were, you know, scientifically minded, and they were going to apply that over and over. And I think what's really heartbreaking is that when kids are doing that, they're kind of doing the scientific method. They're testing something out, but they don't realize that it's really the information that they were taught that was mistaken. They usually begin to internalize that it's them. And so I think this is where that's also very empowering. And then likewise, I think other students, right, they still misspell is as I-Z, but when they realize actually the most common spelling of is the S, that's also very empowering.
I'm wondering if you could actually give us some more examples of that. I'm thinking of, you know, there are teachers out there who might not, even though, you know, we see it all the time, right? We as adults, we see is and we see has and was, we see all those words, but we don't think about that spelling rule, right? Or we don't think about the different ways to say it. I'm wondering if you have any other example, like, because often we see it as that's an exception, or, you know, the English language is just crazy, is how we kind of explain it to kids. Do you have more examples you can share with us of, like, of the English language and some rules that explain it?
Absolutely. So on the phonetic side, one example I like sharing with adults is that most of us learned that T-I-O-N says shun, but then we see a word like partial or confession or confusion even, where you have something else is going on, right? In confession and confusion, you have an S-I-O-N. And really what's happening here is there's three Latin spellings of sh. They're spelled T-I, as in partial. So the word part, it ends in a T, and then they're adding a suffix and it reforms partial. So you can look back to that root. Confess ends in an S. It's going to be spelled with a Latin S-I saying sh, confession. And so, and then with the word confusion, most of us don't even realize that zh, that voiced sound, is a sound in English, but it's spelled with an S-I. S-I says sh and zh, so confusion, division. And when people realize that, it's really helpful. There's also a C-I saying sh. And so understanding this more complete picture, it explains, I think one of the problems is this. We think of phonics, when we teach incomplete phonics, as just for decodable readers. But actually, a complete understanding of phonics is what you were referencing at the beginning. It's how we understand how to decode and encode any word in English.
That's so great. I love that example. It's really helpful. So just to kind of recap, the first is the, just my understanding, the T-I made the sh sound.
Yes.
Right? The shun.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the S-I, but it was voiced and unvoiced.
Yes.
So that actually made two sounds same spelling.
Yes.
Okay. And that's, I loved it when you shared that at the conference, you shared something similar, but that voiced and unvoiced is really, really helpful because it does make two different sounds. And that's something that I always struggled with when I was teaching phonics. Like, kids would ask me questions about, like, for example, the word little, and the word little has the two T's in the middle, but makes a almost like a D sound, right? Little. So it's really about thinking where your placement is of your tongue in your mouth and what's happening with voiced and unvoiced. Do you want to add anything to that? I think that I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Yes. And then also sounds are like colors. I like to talk about that. Like, do you know how when you think of blue, there can be light blue and dark blue and medium shades of blue and ocean blue and sky blue, but we think of them all as blue, and even children see that. So there's something called allophones in English, but really what they are, they're shades of sound. And so that's what you hear in little. And one of the things that I got very interested in was being able to hear Dr. Linnea Airy at the Plain Talk conference that we were just at. And she's heard a number of research studies about how kids, when they feel, what their mouth is doing as they say words, they're able to then orthographically map or connect that to the spelling more quickly and to the sound more quickly. And so I think just as educators, I call that a kinesthetic awareness of sounds, feeling what your mouth is doing, seeing how it's spelled, drawing the connection. And d and t are very close in the mouth. So yes, sometimes there's little changes to the sounds, right? As we speak in the flow of speech, but there's a reason for those spellings too.
So what I'm hearing you say is there's rules and then there's also reasons. So like rules and reasons for why we do what we do. And I guess there's not a rule for example, little. Two T's, does it always say D? No, definitely not. So I think that that's important to think about too. There's rules and then there's reasons for why things are the way they are. And that's what I think you helped us to uncover as we read your book. And so I'm just kind of thinking of how to transition us into this idea that some people are against teaching rules, right? Sometimes people are like, do kids really need to know the rules? I don't necessarily think of that as these rules that we're talking about here. I think of that more in terms of, I don't know, being able to identify that something is a digraph or something. But if we're thinking about these rules in particular, and we're always open to branching off to the other ones, but I just want to be clear, like these rules that we're talking about, the rules of the English language, is what should be taught explicitly versus implicitly?
Yes. And I think what I'm trying to do, I'm going to set this answer up, but I think what I'm trying to do is two things to help people understand English isn't just riddled with exceptions. It's a complex code. And there are actually quite a lot of letter sound correspondences, but I think where we're at in the discussion of science reading is what should be taught explicitly? What should we teach to mastery to students who are emerging readers? And what can be learned implicitly? What can you just learn by reading? And I think that's where the dialogue is right now. And that's what the talk you heard was about. I listened to Sold a Story by Emily Hanford. And at the end of Sold a Story, she says that we should eliminate three cueing. And I thought to myself, I'm gonna think through how would we do that? And it's like, we have to understand why we cue. We have to ask, why do we guess? We guess because we don't know how to teach kids how to decode those words. So when we think about which phonics rules should we teach, we need to look at high frequency words because students read them frequently. And we need to look at their frequency in the language. So just going back to the beginning of this presentation, S saying z is an is and as and has. It's in a lot of high frequency words, but it's also 20,000 times in this data set in Finder. It is very frequent in the language. To me, that creates the threshold. We should teach S's and z explicitly. Now, in contrast, the phonogram PN in pneumonia and pneumatic and pneumothorax, that's only in an advanced vocabulary. So students who understand this is a phonogram, this makes a sound or multiple sounds, when they come across the word pneumonia are going to be able to go, ooh, it's a new phonogram. I wonder what language that's from. That said, we shouldn't tell students when they encounter the word pneumonia, that's an exception. It's actually not. And that word in particular helps us to also understand English is morphophonemic. It's a balance of sound and meaning. Sometimes even our phonograms carry meaning. And in that word, PN carries the meaning of air. So anytime you see it, pneumonia, pneumothorax, it has something to do with air and it's saying N. So I hope that helps to understand. And I think this is where the actual discussion is. We all need to be talking. I think a good question to ask curriculum companies and to ask ourselves is the set of phonograms I'm teaching going to help read high frequency words and read enough of the words on the page that it's not leaving emerging readers just guessing?
Yeah, that they can read most of the words on the page.
Yes.
Yes. It shouldn't be that they can read, I don't know, 5 out of 10 words. And then the other ones are words that they're memorizing or, oh, these are not regular because what I'm hearing you say is they're all regular. They all can be in some way, shape, or form, right? If you wanted to think about it that way, they all can be decoded.
They almost all can be thought of as regular. So this is where my own thinking has been changing this year. I used to say all the time, 98% of English words are follow the rules, which was leaving 2%. And so we run a teacher training. And over those 3.5 days, we teach teachers the phonograms, the rules, how to apply them through spelling analysis. They're teaching each other. And where I'm going with this is during that training on the third day, we give the small groups of teachers all of the Deutsch words. And we dump them out on tables in small groups and we ask them to now categorize them as exceptions or do they follow the rules? And then I lead a discussion where the small groups put them up on a board. And in the past, that room always came up with, there were 3 or 4% of exceptions, which is fine because the high frequency words are the oldest words. So there's the most exceptions. But in 2023, something different happened. So I always have talked about how English is morphophonemic, a balance of sound and meaning. But I also began to integrate in for the first time our training that our goal as teachers, our goal as educators is to help students orthographically map words, to bond the spelling, the sound, the pronunciation and meaning of the word. And we reiterated that theme as we talked about morphology and phonetics. And what happened was that room of almost 90 educators decided that there was really just one exception, and it was the word I, as in my eyeball, E-Y-E. And when I asked them, I was like, well, what about the number 2? And they're like, oh, the W means in 2, as in twin, and twice in 12, it means 2. And even though the W is silent, it's not an exception because we know how to teach students how to orthographically map it using morphology. And I stood back and I watched this discussion and I'm still thinking about that because I think that is the real goal, to understand language well enough to go, I understand something about dialect. I understand morphology. I understand phonetics. I know how to teach every word in English now.
Can you explain why I is not?
No. Well, there's that silent E at the beginning. That's weird. Maybe the silent E at the end is fine. The Y saying I is fine, but I don't know what to do with that first E either. Yeah, I don't know. I've looked at the etymology. I don't have a great answer, but imagine there's 220 Deutsch words and 95 nouns. And out of all the, 310 words, they said there was one word they didn't know how to teach how to orthographically map. And again, I think that's the goal. That to me is redefining the goal.
I can do a mnemonic for it. E-E-Y.
Yes. There you go. And if they orthographically map it, that's fantastic.
Yes. There we go. We have a cool mnemonic for it. If you were listening and not watching, I pointed to each of my eyes and said E-E and then pointed to my nose and said Y. So,
by the way, mnemonic with an M-N.
M-N.
So there's another one. I just wanted to back up to something, Lori. You were talking about the rules. And I just keep thinking about, you know, the teachers that I think are saying we should not teach these rules is because the rules that they know don't always work, right? That's what I'm hearing is like the rules, like what's the vowel one when you put the E at the end, the vowel says its name. Is that did I get that right?
Like hive, right?
Right.
Is that what you mean?
But then there's all these exceptions, right?
Have,
give. So I think that's why, because they haven't had this all of the rules. They've just had these ones that don't always work, then you're stuck with like, oh well, this is not a very good rule if there's so many exceptions to it. But I know that's where we get to with uncovering the logic of English is like, you would never give a rule like that, Denise. Your rules always have a, you know, if it might do that sometimes, but it also does this and this and this.
Well, it'll be, there's 9 reasons for a silent E, and then we help kids identify why is the E needed. And also, I didn't come up with these. As far as I can tell, came from Dr. Orton and Anna Gillingham, Dr. Anna Gillingham. And the little bit of research I've been able to look into, what did Anna Gillingham use to identify if something's a phonogram or should be a rule? It's frequency in the high frequency words and it's frequency in the language. And Logic of English has tweaked a few of them because we have computers that can pull databases, but that's the heart of all that exists right in the Orton Gillingham's original information. So, and I think that's too, where it's really important that we all work together. Like Logic of English teaches AUGH as in laugh and daughter, saying AF. And I did that because the original sources didn't represent women well. And so sons were in those high frequency words lists, but not daughters. And I thought our daughters have to be represented in these phonograms that we're teaching explicitly. And then the word laugh is frequent in children's books too. But if that difference exists in a curriculum and someone wants to teach that differently, that's fine. But the heart and core of this should be the same because of if you use the data to drive those determinations.
Yeah. And I'm actually thinking maybe I misspoke earlier in terms of like that digraph example I gave. I'm trying to think about how to say it differently. I'm thinking like, for example, when students are being taught explicit phonics and certain programs have students memorize the parts of words or map, like underline or map them and explain them. I'm just wondering if we could kind of unpack that a little bit for like a moment. And just think about, is that something that is helpful? And is that related to what we're talking about?
Yeah. So we don't ask kids to memorize this is a digraph or a trigraph or any of those sorts of language. We instead learn IGH says I, and it's spelled with three letters. But then when we're sounding out words, we would say I, and I might hold up three fingers to show it's spelled with three letter I, and then when they write it, we might underline it to show they're working together and take a moment to analyze the word. And one of my goals is to empower students to be able to look at any word and understand phonetically what's happening in it. So word analysis, I think, is really helpful. But you can't teach every word in the language. I mean, a five-year-old knows 10,000 words when they come to school. We don't teach them to decode and encode all 10,000. I think it's much more efficient to teach students how the language works so they can apply that to every word in their vocabulary and then use that to build their vocabularies.
Okay, that's so helpful. And teaching them how the language works and analyzing for I feel like it's a higher meaning versus just memorizing that this combination of letters does this. So I love that idea of really asking students to think a little bit more and to analyze what they have in front of them in terms of the words that they're seeing.
And I used to memorize words, right? Their spelling, L-A-N-G, you know, whatever it was, the letter names. Now, every word I look at, I see those units of sound. I literally can see what's happening in every word. And I think that's what we want for our students, right? To be able to understand it, not to rotely memorize it.
Can I ask you one that I actually saw on the Facebook group this morning? Because I don't know if you're on that Facebook group, Denise, but every day it's like, why does this word do this? Why is this word spelled this way? You would have a field day on there.
Well, I think I just tagged Denise in so many comments in the last few days.
Yeah, because everyone's answer is always like, uncovering the logic of English. Check it out. but I don't know the answer because I didn't have time to look it up and see if it was in your book or not. But they were asking about words that end in TCH, like catch or hitch. Okay. But then there were a few that end in just CH. But I guess there's only, I haven't thought through it, but I guess there's only a few, like much, rich, and such were the ones that they said.
I don't know how many there are, but it's true that there's the spelling of ch, which is three letter ch, and then there's the two letter ch that's at the end as well. And we don't have a rule about that specifically. Maybe we'll discover one. We've sometimes actually had students send us rules and patterns that they've observed, and then we're able to use word databases to look it up and see if it actually is regular or not.
Yeah. The one thing someone said was that rich comes from French. So then they kept the CH from French. I don't know if that's true or not.
much, I would think, is a high frequency word in a native English word. So I don't necessarily try to explain every single little thing. Like the important thing is that a student could read itch, rich, or much, much. It gets a little trickier for spelling, right? But here's the thing. If you can spell a word, you know how to read it. But if you know how to read it, you don't necessarily know how to spell it. So there's a level of mastery there. And then trying to develop that mastery by going, oh, it's three letters in that word in catch, and pointing that out. We create spelling journals this way. So it's organized by sound. So for example, with ch, there would be ch and tch, and they would collect words with those spellings. Well, we know TCH is never at the beginning. That's only at the end. So there's some rules like that that we can put in there. But at the same time, that's the trickiest part, is learning to spell when there's multiple options for spelling.
That's really helpful. And so teachers don't get caught up in all of the trying to explain every single word in the English language to a student.
Exactly. Yes.
It's like you were in the session that Pam Kastner did at Plain Talk. I loved it. She said exactly that, that if you can spell a word, you can read a word, but that if you can read a word, you can't necessarily spell a word. And she brought that to our attention by, at the very beginning, before she said any of that, having us raise our hands if we thought we were great spellers, great readers. Everybody's raising their hand. And then she flashed on the screen. She's like, okay, let's read some words. Accommodate, fuchsia, narcissistic, onomatopoeia. And then she took them all off the screen. She's like, okay, now let's spell those words. I was like, I thought I was a great speller until that word fuchsia really knocked me out.
There you go. Well, you needed one of the Latin spellings of sh for that word. But here's something else that's interesting. They've also done studies with college students, and they've shown that college students who struggle with spelling are not as fluent of readers as those who have those words mastered for spelling, and that when they teach those students how to spell the words, they improve their reading fluency.
Makes sense.
So it makes a lot of sense, but so often our idea of spelling is separated from our idea of reading, but really they're the same skills and a deeper level of mastery of the same skills.
Yeah, it was interesting with the, going back to that example that I gave with onomatopoeia, when Lynn Stone was on, we talked about that word. And the P-O-E at the end.
Yeah.
Poem, right? Like onomatopoeia. And I was like, I never even noticed that. I remember that moment in the conversation. But it's just one of those things where it took one time for somebody to point it out, and I will never forget it, right? It's that, I don't want to say that simple because it's not simple, but it's being intentional about drawing attention to it and then practicing it. And I had already had that word. I already knew what it meant, right? I've used it for 41 years. So I had a leg up there. But
I think what you're pointing out is how I now think about orthographic mapping, bonding the spelling, the pronunciation, and the meaning. You had the pronunciation and the meaning. Now you've bonded that spelling. And I think, too, like, I've been really realizing that, again, that's our goal. Oftentimes, as educators, we want to get distracted and argue about the details. But an example from our training. So in our training, one of the things we do is we analyze frequently misspelled words. And one of those words is guarantee. We use different research from Google and dictionary sites to choose these. And you'll notice guarantee has a G-U, two-letter G. It's G-G-W-A. And it's also in the word guard. So guard is spelled that way. And if you look up the etymology of these words, some of the etymology sites, guard and guarantee are related, and that's why they're spelled this way. Others say, no, they're not related. And I, at first, when I was putting this like choosing this word, I was like, oh goodness, we're going to like erupt in an argument. But I realized this, we are not lexicographers. It's not our job to decide historically, are these words related? Instead, we are orthographic mappers. If guarding and a guarantee and that relationship helps you to remember that they both use two-letter G, then you're golden. If it doesn't help you, that's okay. Move on. But it's like onomatopoeia, right? Like what helps us bond those together, that's the key.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I think that kind of takes us into a practical example. I want to think about decodable books and what this means. Ooh. For
this is going to be my new presentation coming up. So I'm excited. We can talk about this.
Okay. So I don't even know really what question to ask other than if we think about decodable books and we think making every book decodable, if every word is decodable, then we should make, then every book should be decodable. But we do have these things called decodable books now. We have authentic texts or trade books, whatever you like to say. So I guess what's the purpose of each and what else would you say about that?
This is fantastic. Yes, at Plain Talk, our team had a great discussion about this because you see decodable readers popping up everywhere. And I had this realization that when we use the word decodable reader, we're giving a misrepresentation of what is the purpose of these books. Really, we should be calling them controlled readers because they should be fitting within the scope and sequence of a curriculum. And so we should be controlling the phonics in those books to what those students have been taught, because otherwise those words are decodable, but they're temporarily not decodable for those students because they don't know the rules yet. So we should be controlling our readers based on the scope and sequence. But I think the misinterpretation is some people now have the idea, right, that there's decodable books and then there's just real books. And decodable books are somehow one of the steps to reading real books. But in reality, it's like you said, all books are decodable. Every word's decodable when we know the rules. Decodable readers should be called controlled readers and part of our scope and sequences. That's where they have meaning.
I like controlled books too.
We're probably going to change all of our language around this as well, just because of realizing this misunderstanding as we were chatting with people.
It's funny because I feel like now you've brought that to light, and it's something that I think Melissa and I have talked about in the past. Like this, I mean, we didn't read with decodable books, and yet here we are still able to read, right? But because we had mapped the code and we were able to read. But decodable books do have a place, right? But they are with this. And I think it's so helpful that we're doing this for kids. It's important. But I like that idea of reframing. And I struggle too sometimes with, all right, this is a better way to say it, but the general public still calls it this. So I'm sure you're thinking about that too, Denise.
Well, this is a brand new thought from this last week for us to change our language. And you're right, to reframe that we need controlled readers or to lead up to being able to read anything, to help practice the skills that we're learning. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be a challenge to reframe our language as well. And it's not just children who need it. Adults who are learning to read or high school students who are learning to read need to be given texts that are controlled for the phonetic concepts that they've been taught so that they build their fluency and their confidence. And then I'm not a fan of leveled readers, because once students have enough of the code, they're going to be able to read at the same level they can listen and comprehend. We should let them go explore that world. And yes, to keep building their levels, but we shouldn't ever be like, you can't read that yet if they want to and they're capable of it.
We agree with that.
We totally do. I can't tell you how many year after year I kept sending emails to my daughter's school, please no leveled readers for her. Just let her read whatever she would like to read because she can read.
Yes. Yes. Instead, like a program that has a scope and sequence and a student who's not reading yet, you could take other decodable readers and go, what phonetic concepts are in here and where does it fit in the scope and sequence as a controlled reader? That's, I think, where they belong. And once the student's like, I can read anything, go for it. That's the goal. We've opened the world of books to you.
I'm wondering about, I'm thinking of teachers right now in their classrooms and many who have a curriculum that they have to teach, especially for foundational skills. What are some practical ways you think teachers might be able to apply what we've talked about today if, for instance, their curriculum does not necessarily get into everything that we, all the rules that we talked about?
Yeah. Well, hopefully what we've sparked is a little curiosity. So one of the things I say to teachers, if you can just change the habit of saying that's an exception when a student asks a question about words, we would never do that with science, right? We'd never be like, well, I don't know, but that is an exception to the laws of physics. No, we'd go, I don't know. So if you are listening today, I think just one takeaway is to when a kid asks a question or a student asks a question about a word, just say, I don't know. And then go ahead and look it up. On the Logic of English website, there's a free resources section. We publish all the spelling rules for free. We have a chart of all the phonograms and their sounds. You can listen to them. And then another step you can take is, for example, if your program is teaching the letter C, says K, go look on our website, find out if it says a second or a third sound, and incorporate all the sounds right there in your scope and sequence. Or if you're teaching Silanese, go ahead and look up the spelling rules, discover that there's 9 and teach a few more of them at least, because you're going to discover they're very, very helpful and they explain tens of thousands of words. And so using that scope and sequence you have as the base, but just doing your best to fill in some of the holes. And usually people find that that's sparking their own curiosity about the language. The other thing I'd say is be okay with your students that you don't really know the answers and that you're looking it up and learning it with them. Students love when we learn alongside of them. It's okay. This is a huge cultural misunderstanding about language. And I think the way that we get out of the literacy crisis is we all learn more about English together.
Yeah, it also de-shames for our students who are maybe not wanting to ask a question, embarrassed to ask a question, learning the language maybe at a different pace than others. So I think it does bring that, it normalizes the learning experience.
Yeah.
Is there anything we should think about when we're working with students who might learn differently, like such as they might have dyslexia or maybe are English learners?
Yeah, I think students can vary in the amount of practice they need. And so we often get questions like, is learning A-A for the letter A too hard for kids or too hard for students with disabilities? And what I like to talk to people about is this. First of all, young students don't realize that the language, if we tell them that this is A-A right from the beginning, then they have that information. So like, I like to introduce it to young students by saying something like this. How many sounds does a cat make? And they can meow and hiss and, you know, imitate. Or how many sounds does a dog make? Dogs make lots of sounds. Well, in the same way in English, some of our phonograms make more than one sound. So just normalizing them to that idea. And then introducing them all from the beginning. Because if you think about ball, water, call, fall, want, I mean, that aw sound is frequent. It's in, I think, over 2,000 words. It's in high frequency words. So really stepping back as an adult, realizing unlearning is hard. So we are unlearning some ideas that we were taught, but learning it from the beginning, that opens up the world of language. And then practicing, that's the thing. Some students are going to need a little bit of practice. Some are going to need a lot of practice, but make the practice fun. You know, lay the phonograms out on the floor with young kids and jump from phonogram to phonogram, saying the sound, do scavenger hunts, you know, play card games, but internalize that information by playing games and making it fun. And once you have that for life. It really is the information you need to spell a word and to actually use spell checker efficiently. So that said, I don't think with disabilities, even IDA says this is the information, structured literacy, right? But the amount of practice, that's on us with the art of teaching to make that enjoyable and fun.
Can you say more about the use of spell checker? Because I'm just envisioning me myself trying to spell the word simultaneously and not remembering there's a U or there should be a U and then it's a whole different word. And I just imagine that'd be very confusing, especially if I were someone learning English or frustrated and trying to write something. You know, I just think it takes it to a level of frustration really quickly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things I've discovered is pretty much everyone who reads and writes in English has had a moment where you can't get spell checker to recognize the word you want. And it's frustrating. And I thought this was just me until I started speaking in rooms of hundreds of people. And one day I got really brave and asked, how many people have had this experience? And everybody raises their hands. And I'm like, Oh, this is a universal English problem. But I don't have that problem anymore because I know the phonograms. And so it's a combination of segmenting words, our phonemic awareness skills, being able to segment words, and then also knowing, oh, that's the other spelling of ah. Nope, not that one. Note that. Oh, got it. And we're good. But if we don't know how to do those basic segmenting skills, we don't know the options for our spelling or most of them, we're going to struggle with spelling, especially multisyllabic words. But this information, and again, I think that's the misnomer, right? Phonics is for decodable readers like Matt Satt. Really accurate phonics is for the whole language, every word in English.
I love that story you told on your presentation about the man that didn't know how to read and watched one of your presentations and then called you up to talk about it. I was like, I just wish someone would have told me this all from the beginning.
I've had that experience over and over and over and over with people who struggle with reading. And I had someone who had his master's degree and had accommodations and sat in on a similar presentation and came up to me afterwards. And he was like, Denise, what you were saying, I could actually start to understand some of the words on the screen in just that hour. Imagine the pain, right, of trying to figure out how do I navigate education and life without literacy, thinking there's something wrong with me. But really, we were taught a very incomplete code into guess.
Is this a good time to bring up the exception? What is exception?
Oh, sure. I think I kind of referenced that earlier, that what I'm really defining now, since English is morphophonemic, it's a balance of sound and meaning. And by the way, every spelling system is. This is not unique to English. I think what's unique to English speakers is we all think our language is unique and extra hard or extra special or something. But really, it's this balance of sound and meaning. And so you get a number. I gave the example of two with the silent W, and it's in twin. There's two of them twice. You do it two times. And you start to see these relationships and meaning that either explain the spelling, that's an exception, or give you more insight into the words. And all of these help us to orthographically map the words. And I'm starting to think that there's, sure, exceptions to the phonics rules, but that doesn't make them exceptions to the actual written structure of English, which is balancing sound and meaning. And then when we have that bigger picture, we're able to just understand how English works. And that's the goal, right?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure we hit that home right at the end here. So Denise, is there anything you would like to share with our listeners that you haven't shared yet?
No, that's about it. Although we do have a lot of free resources on our website. So if you're curious, check it out, logicofenglish.com. And there's even some free activities there to help you with instruction, some word lists, some practice activities. So I just hope it makes a difference in people's lives and that we can shift culture together, shift the culture of how we understand our language. I think this will truly make a difference in literacy levels in our nation.
And we've already mentioned your book several times, but just in case, if you got to this point, it's Uncovering the Logic of English is Denise's book. And then also, you have an in-person training coming up. Do you want to share about that too?
We do. We have an in-person teacher training in Rochester, Minnesota, June 25th through the 28th. And so we offer this once a year. It's a four-day workshop, and I think last year, one of the things that gave me so much delight is someone from one of the departments of education came up to me at the break. And she said, Denise, I just called my daughter and I told her, I now know how to teach any word in English. I was like, you could ask me and I could teach you how to spell or read that word.
I love that.
So that made me so happy. I've been thinking about that ever since. So hopefully, but we go through, yeah, how English works. We integrate that information with the science of reading, the major studies, helping to understand how these all connect together, the five strands of reading.
All right. We'll link it all in the show notes, and literacypodcast.com is where you can find show notes. You can find it where you listen to podcasts. Just scroll down and click on those notes on your phone. So we are happy to share this information with you. And thank you so much, Denise, for being here with us.
Melissa and Lori, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. To stay connected with us, sign up for our email list at literacypodcast.com. Join our Facebook group and follow us on Instagram and Twitter.
If this episode resonated with you, take a moment to share with a teacher friend or leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
Just a quick reminder that the views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests of the Melissa and Lori Love Literacy podcast are not necessarily the opinions of Great Minds PBC or its employees.
We appreciate you so much, and we're so glad you're here to learn with us.